This is Jessica Yellen, founder of News Not Noise. I analyze the news on social media at Jessica Yellen. I covered the White House for CNN and ABC, and I'm very excited to be your guest host for the next month here at my hometown station, KCRW. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It is the fourth week of April, and this week there was mask confusion on mass transit. First, a federal judge ruled that the mask mandate on planes, trains, and buses exceeds the CDC's authority. Within minutes, airlines were announcing that masks were no longer required, and video went viral of passengers ripping them off mid-flight. Metro agencies, even Uber, had to scramble to set new policies. After the ruling, President Biden said the choice to wear a mask is up to them, meaning up to each American. But now the CDC wants to keep the mandate in place, so the DOJ is appealing to do just that. So, should there be a mandate? And who is in charge here? Let's bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel. I am your guest host and your center, and I'm joined by Tim Carney, columnist at the Washington Examiner and senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute on the right. And on the left, Christine Emba, columnist for the Washington Post and author of the book Rethinking Sex, A Provocation. Hello, Tim and Christine.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Good to be back.
Okay, Tim and Christine, let's get into this. Obviously, Tim, let's go to you. Masks have been an important public health tool, especially before vaccines were available. They've also been one of the most visible symbols of the COVID era and one of the most bitterly fought over government intervention. So it's not a surprise that this decision has some people rejoicing, others a little concerned. It's more surprising the Biden administration was so divided on its response. So my question to you, Tim, is who should be deciding whether to end mask mandates? The CDC, politicians, or judges?
Well, if you read the ruling from that Florida federal judge, there's a first half of the ruling that is a little suspect that gets to the question you're asking, where the judge is saying, well, this doesn't really count as sanitation. I'm forcing people to wear a mask. It gets into the ins and outs where I think I agree with the judge, but I'm a little uneasy. Maybe the CDC should be making that decision. But the second half of her ruling is watertight, which is that even if the CDC should be making these rules, they cut corners. They basically cheated. They said, oh, well, this isn't a new rulemaking. This is just a new order. So that allowed them to avoid the whole process of getting public comment on it, which you do for any new regulation, avoiding that public comment. Maybe one of the public comments would have been, guess what? Airplanes are the best ventilated indoor space in the world. So maybe your mask mandate could apply on a subway, but not on an airplane. They totally avoided that whole process. It was out of line. So even if you want the CDC making these rules, they should be following the federal law on how you make new regulations. They didn't, and that's why they lost in court.
That's interesting. So you're saying this was a process violation by the CDC rather than a statement on the overall mandate?
Yeah, again, the ruling had two parts. The second part, which I think is watertight, was a process violation.
Interesting. Christine, your take. Do you think that it fundamentally undermines the CDC if this ruling is upheld, if the courts say, nope, the CDC does not actually have the authority to issue these mandates?
Well, of course it undermines the CDC. I mean, the CDC is supposed to be the Centers for Disease Control. They're supposed to be seen as the scientific experts, the medical experts who are setting reasonable precautions for the country that theoretically people should listen to. A judge basically saying, no, actually, you don't have to listen to them, definitely undermines their authority. I think, though, that I agree with Tim in some part here. There has been so much confusion and so much, frankly, poor messaging out of the CDC about when you should mask, when you shouldn't, what kind of mask is important, which masks are actually unhelpful and invalid, when you should be using K95s, do cloth masks work, et cetera, that unfortunately it does feel like they have undermined their own authority a little bit. And that is why I think people were sort of rejoicing when a judge came down and said what many of them were thinking, that they could finally make decisions just by themselves. But unfortunately, I think that this sets, you know, a really bad longstanding precedent. If a single individual, even a judge, with presumably no medical or scientific experience or expertise, is suddenly the one to decide what, you know, health and science policy is for the whole country with the stroke of a pen, that could go in some pretty dark directions. And it leaves individuals out to fend for themselves, because there are many people who, for very valid reasons, need to and would like to keep masking, or would be very much helped by having masks still in evidence in public spaces. And many scientists and doctors are saying that this is the case, in fact, that it was too soon.
Well, an Associated Press poll out this week found that 56% of Americans favor a mask mandate for planes, trains, and buses. Just 24% oppose it. Tim, do you think it should matter that the public wants these masks on? And should the administration be taking that into account as they decide their rulemaking?
No, I think the administration is taking into account that that was sort of the timing. We all thought that Biden was going to kind of let this rule go, maybe grouse about it to placate his base, but then to try to not, you know, make masking continue to be part of the political conversation. And then that poll came out and his CDC and DOJ said, no, we're going to fight this. So I think that's what's motivating them. And I think that's the wrong way to do this. Again, if we just look at the lawsuit, the deciding factor was that they rushed out a rule that they pretended wasn't a new regulation. They pretended it wasn't a new rule, and they did it without seeking the public comment in the way that they did. And you don't get to cut corners. That's the bottom line of this. As far as the public opinion goes, I mean, yeah, you shouldn't. It makes it worse to issue a rule that everybody opposes. But in this case, if I'm going to be flying this weekend and I'm not wearing a mask, I'm not going to stop anybody else from wearing a mask. And your KN95 or your N95 on the mask does a very good job of protecting you. And if you ask me to, if you're sitting next to me and you ask me to, I'll put on the mask to make you happy. But the fact that the federal government gets to force me to, that's what's at stake here, and whether or not they have to follow the rules of the road when they make new regulations.
So let me just make sure I'm clear on your position, Tim, because I know that you said on the show previously that you supported early COVID measures, but that you now think that many are government overreach. In this particular case, I understand you are pointing out the process violation, but do you think the CDC should have the authority to issue a mask mandate right now?
I think the CDC has the authority to issue a mask mandate, and they shouldn't do it.
Because of the science?
Because of the science.
Okay, Christine, you pointed out that people are confused. It's as if we're going to leave things up to the individual. We need government entities to tell us what their decisions should be. But the irony is, this week, President Biden literally said it's up to them. You know, when you're making choices about whether to wear a mask, it's up to them. And I've been joking with some of my friends that America's new motto is up to you, America, up to you. Smoking on planes, up to you. Wearing a seatbelt, up to you. Obviously, I'm exaggerating this, but do you think the president has sort of lost the politics on this once he's taken that position?
Yeah, I think that joke is both funny and sad, because it seems so true, frankly. I mean, the pandemic's not over, unfortunately. You know, there are about 10,000 people in the hospital with COVID right now. Long COVID is still a very real scourge. The coronavirus itself is continuing to evolve. And, you know, there are many portions of America, whether disabled, immunocompromised populations, babies and children who can't be vaccinated, who are still really vulnerable to COVID. And so to those people who, you know, actually prioritize these concerns, which, you know, you would wish would be everybody, because I think in a society, in a country, we are supposed to be responsible for each other and have that duty to each other. The repeal and even Biden's statement that, well, it's up to the individual, just feels like the country and even the administration has kind of given up on mitigating the pandemic, and now has sort of created an incredibly devolved environment where risk calculus and risk assumption is just an entirely personal question. And the government, which theoretically actually is supposed to be helping us look out for the health and safety of ourselves and others, is just not going to help here, not going to give anybody recourse to say, you know, well, I have this vulnerability, I would like to ask you to wear a mask as is required. Because the thing is, you know, Tim, as you were saying, if somebody were to ask you to wear a mask sitting next to you on a plane, you would say yes, presumably, and that's what you said. But there are so many other people who unfortunately are frankly kind of antisocial and would refuse despite the risks and the vulnerability of their fellow citizens. And the government will no longer help those fellow citizens find recourse.
Well, I've even heard reports of flight attendants who are privately relieved that this mask mandate was waived so they have less aggressive behavior on flights. It has nothing to do with science, just they don't want to be the schoolyard cop anymore. I'm curious, a Pew Research poll from February found that 60% of Americans said public health recommendations on how to stay COVID safe leave them feeling confused. So Americans were super confused about the rules before this week. All of this, I have to imagine, Tim, only increases not just the uncertainty about how to behave with COVID, but also sort of faith in our institutions. Like, who is the authority figure we should look to? Who does give us guidance on what we should and shouldn't do? Where do you think this leaves the American people right now?
Well, right now we are really in a crisis of this sort of radical agnosticism. And I encounter this all the time. I go around the country, I talk to, you know, the average guy at a coffee shop or a bar, a college campus or a church parking lot. And more the phrase I hear is, I just don't know what to believe. And the COVID stuff, the mix, the confusing messaging that you and Christine were referring to earlier, it adds to it, but it existed before. And when, you know, I was in Washington on January 6th, and when I was talking to the people who were walking on the way to the Capitol, they just basically said, I trust nobody anymore. I have no faith that, like, things aren't, you know, they didn't trust Rudy Giuliani, Donald Trump. They certainly didn't trust CNN or, you know, or a Republican Secretary of State in Georgia. There's a total destructive loss of faith. So I don't have a good answer for your, like, who are people going to trust. What I'm going to say is that we really are experiencing this crisis of authority in America. And I'm a guy who, my job and my ideology both say always question power, always question authority. And now I see that, you know, these things, at the end of the day, nobody's arriving at any answers. And that's pretty harmful.
Christine, we've been critical of the Biden administration for their messaging on this one. But is it also true that this is potentially an impossible situation where the science is changing, there's resistance in the public, and we are in new terrain? Do you think they're purely responding to public opinion when they're now saying they want to enforce the mask mandate? Or do you think it's also a process of figuring out what the public health experts really do advise in this situation?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think that it's the latter, actually. I mean, of course, the administration is being pushed by public opinion, but there is also the understanding that the COVID situation and our understanding of the coronavirus is continually evolving. The science is clear in some cases, but of course, that's always evolving too, and there are disagreements to be hashed out. But this is also what science looks like. And you can communicate that this is happening while also being very clear about where we stand moment to moment.
I think we've identified one area we all agree on, which is this lack of faith in institutions, whether it's government or scientific leaders or the media even, is a real problem. I do my work on social media and I see it every day when people message me. They are so primed to disbelieve. You know, they're trained to look for fake news or conspiracies or political ideology in the information. But it's almost as if no one's been taught discernment in how to know what to believe, where to look for leadership. And it's leading to this incredible anxiety, especially when people are making, as you're saying, more and more consequential decisions at the local level about health and the future, et cetera. I guess it kind of leaves open the question, if we get a deadly new variant or another pandemic, a new virus, who will we look to? Will we even have faith in our existing institutions to guide us on that? This has been a great conversation. We'll be back in a few moments with Christine Emba and Tim Carney to talk with David Green, who is on the ground in Ukraine. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
This is Left, Right, and Center. We're changing things up, but always keeping it civilized yet provocative. Let us know what you want to hear or who you want to hear from. You can ask a question or leave a comment at kcrw.com/LRC.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Jessica Yellen, founder of News Not Noise and former White House correspondent for CNN and ABC. Russia announced this week it successfully tested a new intercontinental ballistic missile. Russian President Vladimir Putin says it's, quote, capable of overcoming all missile defense systems and would make those who try to threaten our country think twice. Meanwhile, the Biden administration has announced they will continue to provide resources, including another $800 million of weapons and supplies beyond what they already pledged last week. And it appears the Russian military is bombarding the southeastern region of Ukraine as a way to lead up to a major ground offensive there. We're joined now by our special guest and good friend of Left, Right, and Center, David Greene. He is a former Moscow correspondent for NPR and is now the co-founder of Fearless Media, where he is host of Ukraine Stories. He is joining us now from Kyiv, Ukraine. David, hi. Thanks for being with us.
Of course, Jessica. It's good to hear your voice.
Oh, my gosh. It's so great to talk to you. And I'm so impressed and proud of you for being in Ukraine covering this now. Here at home, the coverage is really focused on the fighting in the east, the U.S. promise of more weapons, and even Putin backing off Mariupol. But what do you hear from people on the ground there?
You know, certainly many people are following the big headlines and want to, you know, understand what's happening broadly in this war and in their country. But I think this is one of the realities of war, right? A lot of people are focused on much more personal things. You know, if you fled somewhere, you're dealing with the trauma of that. I've spoken to so many people who are like, they can't be outside without thinking about where the safe basement is close by. You know, you're wondering if your missing loved one back in Mariupol or Donetsk is alive. And, you know, even people who are, you know, touched less directly are still touched. You know, it's, can I go back to my apartment in Kyiv? Is it safe enough? Can I go visit my family in a place that might be dangerous? You know, if I have three families who fled violence and are staying in my flat right now, like, you know, it's a hotel and I went to stay with my parents to give them space. When will life go back to normal? So this is just, you know, it's touching everyone. And so I think people are so much more focused on like the next hour and the next day, if that makes sense.
What is it like to be an American there? I wonder, do people find out you're American and express, I don't know, gratitude that the West is supplying weapons and engaged? Do they tell you they're disappointed, we're not doing enough? Do they want more?
I mean, it's interesting. Like, I spent a lot of time reporting here, you know, some years ago, and this is a place where Americans were just embraced. You felt that love when you were here, when I was on Maidan and, you know, talking to young political activists. It's strange. It's a little different now. There's not a dislike, but I get this feeling of the United States is like the sibling who's taken care of the relationship for so long, but they're just not feeling all the love right now from that sibling. You know, I was talking to a human rights lawyer who's investigating war crimes here, and he's collected evidence from Bucha and the suburbs that were occupied by the Russians. I mean, just horrific atrocities, you know, just Russian soldiers shooting people point blank and torturing them and, you know, living in their houses and making them go down to the basements. And at the end, you know, he said, all of this evidence isn't going to mean anything if the United States and the West don't step up. You know, Russia has veto power on the UN Security Council, and if Russia is going to be held accountable for the behavior of its soldiers, it's going to take the United States and the West, you know, taking a stand. So it's requests like that that I get, like, go home and send this message to your country. We need you right now.
Well, can I ask you to help us understand that? Does that mean the West taking a stand looks like us sending troops in to fight alongside Ukrainians, or is there anything short of that they feel we should be doing to get their back?
No, you don't hear a lot of people saying, I wish the 82nd Airborne were inside, you know, fighting. I mean, it's much more keep sending weapons, keep sending, you know, support, do anything you possibly can, you know, and also punish Russia economically, you know, in the fiercest way possible. It's those kinds of things. You don't hear anyone anticipating that could be possible, that President Biden could actually send troops. But it's everything short of that, I think.
Well, can I ask about the punishing of Russia? Because obviously we're doing that. We should be doing more of it. But if peace is ever going to happen, one of the sort of uncomfortable debates here is like, at some point, is there something Putin could do, pull out or something like that, where then we let them have back some of what we've taken away as far as trade or access to bank accounts. But it just seems so wrong to reward a guy who's invaded a country and killed all these people by at some point letting up. I got to imagine there's an anger and a vengeance in there in Ukraine that's 100 times stronger. Is there any evidence that, you know, how could people live with a peace with Putin? But eventually that's what we're going to need, right?
Yeah. And I mean, this is a country where a lot of people lived with a peace with Putin for a long time. I mean, this is a place where people are very familiar with Russia. I mean, the war in the East has been raging. It's really interesting. You go, you know, I went to Zaporizhia down, you know, getting towards the East, and people there were saying, you know, this war didn't begin a few weeks ago. This war has been raging for years now, you know, in Donbass. So there was this feeling of like, this is a reality that is part of life, you know, the annexation of Crimea. I mean, things like that. It's just this invasion, I think, went so far beyond what people ever really imagined and anticipated. And so there is a feeling of vengeance. There is a feeling of anger. I think President Zelensky has a lot of support right now for the hard line that he's taking. But I think it's a really good question. I mean, my question is, if these atrocities continue, you know, if Putin, you know, who's declaring victory in Mariupol now, you know, goes on and more people are dying and more cities are under siege and more people are disappearing and starving, will there begin to be a call from Ukrainians for Zelensky to do something, even if it means backing down? But it sure doesn't feel like we're there yet among Ukrainians.
David, I'm curious, you're in Kyiv. When we hear about the war, the military efforts are focused on the east and until now Mariupol. Does it still feel dangerous in Kyiv itself? Are they still bracing for anything?
I mean, I think bracing is more the word than dangerous. There's a weird calm here. You know, there were still airstrikes, you know, on some days. The air raid sirens go off, you know, every few hours, and it just becomes kind of the soundtrack to life here, and no one, you know, a lot of people don't even pay attention, which might be dangerous. But yeah, I mean, people are slowly coming back. I mean, one of our local colleagues just came back to her apartment for the first time since the invasion. She saw all of the devastation in the suburbs, cried as she came in, but then got into the city and felt this sense of relief because it's like her city is still, it's still here. I mean, a lot of businesses are closed. It's much quieter than usual, but it's still here. And so I think bracing, yes, because, you know, everyone here knows that Vladimir Putin is unpredictable, but there is a feeling that the front line still remains far away and there hasn't been this barrage of missile strikes anytime recently. And so everyone is kind of on edge. I kind of compare it to a lot of what we lived through in COVID. It's like you're, especially in the early days, you know, it's like, I don't know what I'm allowed to do. Like, is it safe to walk outside? Is it safe to breathe? When do I have to wear a mask? I mean, that's the way a lot of people in this city are living life right now. Like, what I want to live life, but like whatever I'm thinking about doing next, like, is it okay?
I know you lived in Moscow for 3 years. Do you hear from your contacts in Russia? Because we hear so much about the disinformation they are fed. If you're in touch with people in Russia, what's their impression?
I mean, I think it's just, if you thought it was disinformation and difficulty accessing the truth, you know, it's now tenfold. And I think a lot of people, more so than disinformation, are scared of what information they actually put up, like on social media. I mean, this threat, and you know, there've always been threats, but now it seems scarier than ever. Like that, you could serve 15 years in prison if you put up anti-Putin stuff on social media. So I've talked to a lot of people who just used to feel like they could have a voice, and now they're just being quiet as ever. And then a lot of people are leaving and fleeing. And, I think you're talking about a lot of more educated activists and you know, they're leaving the country.
Christine?
I was wondering actually about that. Do you think that this is contributing to Putin's mental state and the continuation of warfare? I mean, it seems like all of the reporting that we're hearing suggests that he now even believes that he's winning this war. And that's why he doesn't seem to be backing down in any real way. Has that misinformation gone so full circle that there's no way out?
I mean, I've read a lot of the reporting that he is, you know, has this tight circle that is basically feeding him stuff that is not true. And I think aspirationally, he probably hopes that he is winning this war, but I have got to believe that his intelligence is good enough that he knows exactly what is happening. He knows that a really important Russian vessel sank and was hit by Ukrainian missile. And I think you see the propaganda that is so important to him playing out right now with Mariupol. I mean, you know, it looks like Russian forces decided not to go in and engage in that last battle with Ukrainians. And to Ukrainians, that was a sense of like, wow, we've, you know, we've repelled them and our soldiers hidden in the in a steel plant held on. But Putin is trying to say this was victory and trying to say that Russia is now in control of Mariupol. And I think it, you know, you hear messages like that from Putin, and then it takes a matter of days to actually find out what the truth is.
Tim, let me bring you back in here and talk a little bit about public opinion here. Putin is an obvious enemy, but sometimes conversations in America bleed between Putin and the Russian people. Do you feel that at home we've over-vilified the Russian people?
Absolutely. And you see these institutions who are barring, you know, a tennis player or a musician or whatever because they are Russian. Now, that's not to say that there aren't some Russian celebrities who have been pro-Putin. I think Alex Ovechkin, one of our hockey stars here in Washington, D.C., needs to at least provide an account while he gets celebrated every day for having called himself Team Putin a few years ago. But absolutely. I mean, this is one of the things that's in America's history. In the World Wars, we did it to the Germans and the Japanese, et cetera, and ever since then. And it's scary that it's not just sort of your average Joe. It's not even primarily your average Joe who's turning against the Russians. It's these institutions who think that they can sort of showcase their virtue and stand up to Putin by, you know, barring a Russian tennis player. It's shameful and confused.
Christine, you know, there are reports that come from the Ukrainian government saying that more than 5 million Ukrainians have fled the country. How do you think the world has been doing managing this movement of people? And is the United States in particular doing enough?
Yeah, very interesting question. I think that this invasion was such a surprise, even though perhaps it shouldn't have been to many, that the outflow of refugees immediately was felt to be overwhelming and unexpected. That said, countries in Europe especially have been very welcome in opening their doors almost immediately to Ukrainian refugees. And that has, you know, stood in contrast to how they have dealt with refugee flows from other areas. The United States has, you know, made many statements about how welcoming it will be to refugees, how it's easing up on immigration regulations in part to support people fleeing from this war. But at the moment, we are kind of lagging behind. We haven't really loosened our immigration standards quickly enough that the sheer number of refugees who want to enter the U.S. after Ukraine have been able to find a process here. I think the Biden administration has said that they will be doing more soon, and I'm waiting to see that.
David, I understand you spent some time on the Polish border. I'm curious what you've seen with your own eyes, and do you think the United States should be doing more or doing it differently?
You know, I think everything that I've been following, President Biden has been saying the right things, you know, but then you've had Ukrainians who decided to go to Mexico and try to get across the U.S. southern border, and it looked like there were going to be some exemptions, and now it looks like President Biden has unveiled a new program that will require Ukrainians to go through a whole process to get approval. And the message is don't come to Mexico and cross the southern border, even though there are a lot of Ukrainians already in Mexico trying to come across the southern border. So, you know, typical U.S. immigration policy, absolutely confusing and impossible for anyone to understand what the rules are. So I think clarity would be something that would be helpful. And I will just add your other question, Jessica, I really hope that people do not punish the Russian people for Vladimir Putin. I mean, and I've been seeing that. I saw that in Warsaw. A Russian-owned restaurant was vandalized. I mean, I've spoken to a Georgian woman who got to Tbilisi fleeing Russia. She couldn't get into restaurants in Georgia because she's Russian. I mean, I know there is anger, and I know this is a murderous thug who is leading Russia right now and doing terrible things in Ukraine, but it's, you know, we're at a moment where, you know, the world is very black and white. And in this war, the world should be black and white, but not when it comes to how we treat people. And Russians who are just clinging to their culture and homeland and are not out there, you know, supporting what Vladimir Putin is doing, we should really keep in mind who the real enemy is.
David, I want to give you the last word here because you are there. Is there anything that you wish an American audience understood about what's happening on the ground or the stories of people of Kyiv you'd like to share?
It's a good question. I'll tell you one of the many voices that is, you know, that moved me this week as we've been talking to people for our show. This guy, Alexei Simonov, he led this daring rescue out of Mariupol a few weeks ago. And I mean, it just, the description of hiding in a shelter and setting up like a city underground and then saying, this is the day we're all leaving. And he led like half of the people out through the streets, shelling. They got to buses. They had to go through 17 Russian checkpoints to get to freedom. And we were talking at the end of the conversation. He just said, you know, there's still 150 people left there in that shelter. You know, many of them wanted to leave, but were scared. They were too traumatized to come up above ground. And he has no idea what's happening to them. And he just said, please tell the world that there are still people alive and trapped in Mariupol because the world needs to know that. And that just, you know, that cuts right through you when you hear that. Those are the realities of war that I think we all need to remember.
It is just one heartbreaking story after another. David, thank you for being there, bringing these stories to us. Please stay safe.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it, Jessica.
Special guest David Green is host of the podcast Ukraine Stories from Fearless Media. I've been talking with Christine Emba and Tim Carney. We'll be back to talk about Don't Say Gay Bills, plural. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
New year, new show. We're making changes to Left, Right, and Center, and you can weigh in. Leave a comment or ask us a question at kcrw.com/LRC.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Jessica Yellen, founder of News Not Noise. On the right is Tim Carney, columnist at The Washington Examiner. On the left, Christine Emba, columnist for The Washington Post. We've heard a lot about Florida's so-called Don't Say Gay bill. Florida is not the only one, though. More than a dozen other states have introduced similar legislation limiting how gender and sexuality are discussed in school. I interviewed White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki this week, and I asked her why this issue surfaced when it has.
The political games and harsh and cruel attempts at laws or laws that we're seeing in some states like Florida, that is not a reflection of the country moving to oppose LGBTQ plus communities. That is not what we see in data. That is not factual. And that is not where things stand. This is a political wedge issue and an attempt to win a culture war. And they're doing that in a way that is harsh and cruel to a community of kids, especially. I'm going to get emotional about this issue because it's horrible. But you know, it's like kids who are bullied, and like all these leaders are taking steps to hurt them and hurt their lives and hurt their families.
Christine, I talked to her for my podcast and you saw she got emotional, but I'm curious, do you think she's right? Is anti-LGBTQ legislation really about giving parents more control, or is it a political wedge issue?
Yeah, I do think that she's right, that it is a wedge issue. I wrote a piece last week, actually, about the kind of ridiculous use of the term groomer on the right as a way to describe presumably anyone, even people on the right, who, you know, supports allowing sex ed for kids in elementary school. You know, that's just not correct. It's not topical. It doesn't really even address the relationship that, you know, children should have with their parents versus schools versus, you know, teaching capacities. And it seems that this isn't about actually keeping anyone safe. It's just about making voters angry enough at someone else to come out.
And let me follow up with you, Christine, first. Do you believe that these bills reflect where the American public stands?
You know, it seems that they don't, actually. And I think when the bills are explained, rather, there are certain segments that are relatable to most parents. The idea that parents want to be involved in, you know, setting up the curriculum for their students, that they want to know what their kids are being taught at appropriate ages. But the way that they're being framed, you know, as that they are keeping pedophiles out of school, that they're making sure that, you know, LGBT people don't prey on small children, that's not what's happening in the world.
And the American people, you argue, know that. Tim, I want to give you a chance to respond to Jen Psaki, but first, do you want to say why you what you believe the point of these bills is, and what's misunderstood in the coverage of them?
Most parents know and believe that parents, not schools, are the primary educators of their children. Specifically, that is true when it comes to things that involve values. Christine knows very well and has written a very good and compelling book about how the efforts to detach sexuality from values, beliefs, morals, etc., is total folly. So sex education, especially for younger children, is primarily a thing for parents. And we also know that lots of teachers and lots of schools believe that their job is to change the world. And in many cases, this means to try to liberate children from the traditional views of their parents. So if you're somebody who's on the more traditional 66% of the parent population, you know that a lot of public school systems are going to be working against you on what you think is right, what you hold to be true about sexuality and gender. Whether the state legislature is the right place to fight that fight, I think I disagree with a lot of my fellow conservatives on that. Whether these laws are finally honed to do that, I think they're probably not. But where this fight is coming from is parents who say, ideologues are trying to teach our children stuff that we believe is wrong. Somebody needs to stop it.
So let's be specific about this. You began the answer by talking about sexual education. The language of the Florida bill bars, and I'm quoting here, classroom instruction by school personnel or third parties on sexual orientation or gender identity. And the preamble to the Florida bill, its authors write that their aim is to prohibit classroom discussion about sexual orientation or gender identity. So it's not specific only to sex ed. Right. We're talking about the possibility that the way this is written, it could preclude kids from saying they're gay or acknowledging that their parents are.
And what you're making the case about is the confusing and contradictory wording of that bill. In some cases, it says instruction, and in the preamble, it says discussion. And so that's sort of self-contradictory. But also, again, I'm a guy who doesn't think we should have a lot of big centralized laws, either on the federal level or on the state level. Legislation that's passed centrally that makes big laws will have unintended consequences, and by creating the ambiguity can make a teacher think, oh, well, we shouldn't talk about that. Now, just a quick side note, I teach in a classroom, it's Sunday school, and I know that there's certain discussions we're not supposed to, I often say, hey, you know what, that's something to talk about with your parents. There is a widespread perception that school teachers, especially for younger kids, aren't saying, hey, that's something to talk about your parents, but they're taking this issue on, thus the push for this sort of legislation.
Well, so that's an interesting point there, though. You say there's a widespread perception that this is happening, but is this actually happening? How many teachers are going into classrooms and secretly talking to children about how they should change their sexual orientation? It actually does not seem clear that that is happening on the wide scale that these overheated laws would suggest. And in fact, the fact that they are now taking up so much space in conversation, in Republican attacks on any political opponents, suggests that it's kind of a cynical exploitation of both loaded language and a scary subject.
Yeah, if Christine and I were the majority and minority leaders of the Florida state legislature, this debate would obviously look different. But it's not a made-up problem because, again, we know from school district level published materials, and we know from teachers admitting it, whether it's on Zoom calls or on everybody's favorite Twitter feed, the libs of TikTok, that there are teachers out there. Are they 1% of 1%? Who are, you know, saying every day, come in and pick your own pronoun on a pin and put it in there, and whichever way you feel like it, and don't tell your kids. I hope it's only 1% of 1%. I think in this internet day, it's very easy for people to take all sorts of minor threats or very rare, weird things and imagine that it's going on everywhere. I don't doubt that that's some of what's going on here. But then it would also be useful to talk about some of the substance and to say, are we, with a lot of these gender issues, jumping from, hey, let's make sure that everybody, that there's no bullying, that everybody's tolerant, that there's more understanding, to, hey, let's rewrite all the rules of society and abolish the differences between the sexes. That's sort of the substantive issue that we're glossing over by focusing on, does libs of TikTok represent more than 1% of 1% of the teachers?
Let me just help folks who aren't on TikTok know, the libs of TikTok is a viral account that just was written up in a Washington Post piece, is run by a real estate salesperson in New York, and she reposts sort of the most outrageous, crazy, viral videos of teachers and sex educators talking about, you know, things that will go viral on TikTok. Clearly not a representation of the mass or majority of the center of America. Can we agree on that?
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, Tim, if you're acknowledging that there is a need to be clear about what is and isn't taught in school, but that this bill in particular is written in such a broad way that it's potentially sloppy, are you in support of this bill, or do you think this needs to be reconsidered?
I think that I would reconsider it, but I do think that you should say a state has the right to make sure that school districts aren't doing things that harm children and take away the fundamental authority of parents to be the primary educators of their children. And so if I were a state legislator here in Maryland, I would probably try to push something like that because of some of what I know is going on in our local public schools. I would fail because I'd be in a minority of 20% of the legislature. But in Florida, I think some fine-tuning could make it be a good bill to make sure that that school districts are enforcing that teachers aren't leading classroom instruction that is age inappropriate, specifically on sexuality.
Christine, can you speak to some of the ways that this legislation, in theory, could potentially criminalize hallway discussion of gay parents? Do you believe it could? Do you think it's meant to prevent heterosexual students talking about their heterosexual parents' marriage or their own gender orientation?
Well, of course it's not. And I think that's why many people have taken issue with the bill. And I think when you talk to teachers and administrators about what they fear in these bills, it is exactly that they're overbroad, that teachers worry that they might be criminalized or punished for even, say, mentioning that they have a same-sex partner if a kid asks about it, that if a child asks something about their teacher, they might have to hide things about themselves that aren't actually necessarily harmful to kids, that, you know, should be able to be stated. If a, you know, heterosexual teacher can say, I have a wife, basically, this is my wife in this picture on my desk, I think a gay teacher would ask, why am I not allowed to say the same thing? Why is that labeled as, you know, grooming or pedophilia in some way? Why are we making this orientation seem evil as opposed to also talking about the other? But I mean, I think we started this conversation. I think you started the conversation by asking if this was being used as a wedge issue. And I think that's kind of the important question. Is this the biggest problem that Republicans see in the United States right now? Is this the biggest political issue, the hill to die on? It shouldn't be. There are so many other problems that they could be focusing on, whether it's the state of our roads or our economy or anything else. The fact that they're stating on this, perhaps, we don't even know, 1% of 1% problem, and using such loaded language and loaded rhetoric, including what Tim said about, you know, whether we're teaching children that they need to abolish gender and, you know, imbibe this new ideology, suggests that, you know, there's something going on here. There's a reason why we're focusing on this kind of scary and out there question rather than the real issues.
Well, but there is a culture war going on, and there is a massive push to totally rewrite the way that we think of gender and sexuality, and we see it as harmful. If you go into a public school in a lot of parts of the country, you will find a vast number of teenagers saying, well, you know, I'm bisexual or pansexual or asexual, and you have to wonder, is this a healthy thing? Is this something that is just, well, this is my true identity? identity, and now I'm able to admit it in a way that people in generations past didn't. That's the common liberal interpretation of it. But I think just as likely it's average teenage angst is being given this language of gender ideology, of sexuality, and this very modern terminology, and that way of acting out your average teenage angst could end up being more harmful in the long run than simply what we did when we were young, which was, you know, grow your hair long, shave it, dress like a goth, wear a tutu around school, all these other ways that we had to act it out that weren't sort of funneled into an ideological way. So we say, yeah, you know what? The culture is changing really rapidly. And one of the reasons I'm a conservative is that I think dramatic, rapid changes to very complex systems tend to have unforeseen negative consequences. And that's what's going on. And so that it is kind of a big issue if our whole understanding of sex, sexuality, and gender is being rewritten without any of us having any idea this was coming the day before yesterday.
So goth, Tim, can I just follow on that really quick, and I'll let you and Christine next. I'm curious, I hear what you're saying about this concern about parents having a say and change happening so rapidly. What is the, where is the consideration for mental health of young people when they're having an unprecedented mental health crisis? And do you acknowledge that this could trigger more bullying?
I think that if what you as an individual are going through suddenly becomes part of a statewide and nationwide political debate, it's going to make it more harmful, yes, which is one of the reasons that I don't like a lot of things decided by politics and decided by government, and wish that this, again, was happening more on a more local level where the debates would be about specific facts and would be done with more sensitivity.
Well, this is a conversation we could keep going with, but I also think we'll have another 2+ years to discuss it, because I suspect this will be one of the key issues going into 2024. We've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Tim Carney, what's your rant?
I love sports, and I have on occasion placed wagers on a big game, but the new sports gambling businesses such as DraftKings or Caesars Sportsbook are leaving a very bad taste in my mouth. I'm not here to object that they exist. I'm bothered that they are endorsed by people and entities who should care more about regular people who will be exploited. These online sports books are not simply giving you a way to bet on who will win the National League East. Their bread and butter are, quote, prop bets, nearly random wagers on pointless questions such as which player will score the first basket in the upcoming Warriors-Knicks game. And the teaser deals they offer, a guaranteed win on your first bet, reek of an effort to suck in the vulnerable and to foster addiction. So when Major League Baseball partners with these sports books, and your local radio station sports guy voices endorsements for them, and your governor names an official sportsbook partner of the state, this gives a stamp of approval to a business that is essentially predatory.
Okay, Christine Emba, it is your soapbox.
I was talking to a friend recently who pointed out that today, when he tries to have conversations about ethical mores or norms or social infractions, Americans especially tend to transpose the conversation to simply laws and rights. Well, I'm allowed to do something. You don't have to ask any questions. And one has to wonder if America has become so libertarian in ethos that we've dispensed with the social contract entirely. In my new book, Rethinking Sex, I suggest that consent is being over-relied on as a rubric for understanding what good sex looks like. And in part, because it's part of this bigger question. Consent is a contract, and it again allows us to say, well, I've done something and it's not technically illegal, so it's fine. I don't have to think about it further than that. But if we only focus on what's legal, not what's just or moral, we're punting on much bigger questions of ethicality and care. What's good not just for us, what serves not just our own pleasure, but how we create a world at large that is good for all of us. The fact that we're losing sight of that in America, whether it comes to COVID or sex, worries me deeply.
My rant is about legislating classroom instruction and school boards becoming ground zero in the 2024 campaign. Right now, kids in America are dealing with an unprecedented mental health crisis. From preteens to kids in their 20s, they are struggling with the effects of social media, isolation because of the pandemic, fears about the environment, nuclear war, inflation, the economy. Older kids are struggling with student debt. Yes, parents have every right to take an interest in what and how their kids are educated. But my plea is, whether you're talking about race, gender, orientation, or just how math is taught, make the rules clear. Clarity is compassion. Make the intentions transparent. Let the debates be honest. Keep kids' mental health front and center. That's all we have time for today. My huge thanks to Tim Carney, Christine Emba, and David Green. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Laura Dimillion. Our production assistant is Nisha Venkat. The show was recorded and mixed by John Meek. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Jessica Yellen. Thanks for joining us. Tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.